Hey, welcome back to episode 35 of Black Tomatoes here at Black Hollywood Live. We got a little Great Pumpkin, we got a little Vox Lux, we got a little Colette, and we got a little Gary Michael Walter. Stay tuned. What's happening? I was waiting for some music and it did not happen. Okay, well, anyway, hey, welcome back. This is episode 35 of Black Tomatoes. I am your host, Carla Renata, and we have a very, very special show for you. So in addition to our streaming pick of the week and some other little goodies that we do at the end of the show, I am joined back by my co-host, Scott Menzel.
I'm here.
But before we get to Scott Menzel, I want to introduce my special co-host, or our special co-host for this episode. He is a fantabulous producer with many multitude of films under his belt and credit. His name is Mr. Gary Michael Walters.
Thank you. I love the 2001 reference in that opening music, by the way.
Yeah, you know, that's how we roll here at Black Hollywood Live. That's what we do.
I was not expecting that. I loved it.
Oh, good. Yeah. Glad to hear it. Welcome back, Scott.
Thank you. How are you, my dear?
I'm good.
And I'm so happy to be here with you, sir.
I'm so happy to be here with you, Scott.
There you go.
Very close.
There you go. Yes. Yeah.
They're in close
We're
proximity.
We're playing footsies on our table. It's all right.
Hey.
No spoilers.
So let me just start off by saying I met Gary at the premiere showing of Colette here in Los Angeles on the red carpet where I interviewed him. And I said to him, we had another conversation after the red carpet at the party, and I said, so I would love to have you on the show.
Thank you.
He said, oh, let me give you my card. I'm like, okay, so when I call or email you, don't act like you don't know me, because I'm going to feel some kind of way if you do that.
Oh, come on.
And that's what he said.
Who would
come
do
on.
That?
It's Hollywood. You know, yes, everybody does that.
People say things they don't mean.
Really, Gary? See, here we go. Here we go. He's already starting.
Is that a new thing?
He is already starting.
I'm not Hollywood like that.
You know you're not. And that's why I asked you to come on the show, because I thought you were mad cool.
Thank you.
I thought you were a breath of fresh air. I love the films that you're producing now and then, and we just want our listeners and our viewers to know a little bit more about you so that they can get on the Gary Michael Walters bandwagon, too.
Plenty of room.
So the first one I want to talk about is the film that I met you through, is Colette.
Wow, what a great picture.
Oh, my goodness.
I love this one.
So this film is about this woman whose husband is suppressing her, literally putting his thumb on her back to stop her from being her authentic self as an author. She's written this book called Claudine, and it's a true story. She's written this book called Claudine, and her husband takes credit for it, right?
Well, it's more like a Romana Clef, where it's sort of loosely autobiographical.
Ooh, look at that, Romana Clef. Look at you using big phrases.
It's like a cinephile podcast. Pull out the long syllable.
Look at you. I love you for that. I'm learning something. I'm learning something new about you, Gary Michael Walters.
Drop a little knowledge.
But it's the lead role of Colette is played by Keira Knightley.
She's amazing.
She's fantabulous. And I said to her on the red carpet, it has been very interesting to me that she has a journey of playing in period pieces. She's really good in them.
She's excellent at them.
She's really good in period pieces. But I specifically asked her what drew her to this one. And she said, because this woman was strong. She was not a weak-minded woman. She had her own mind. She knew what she wanted to do. She knew how she wanted to go about doing it. And she just did it. And she thinks that the story is important enough that it needs to be told.
Colette was a towering literary figure at a time where there were not many
women.
major female authors. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, at that time, just contemporary was George Sand, mm-hmm. who had to publish under a male name. And it was very strongly discouraged. So when Colette wrote Claudine at School, it was based on her school years.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband had a lot of ghostwriters, so he shoved his name on a lot of things.
He did, not just hers. Yeah.
More of a brand than and I mean, if you look at it today, you'll see a lot of, for example, music producers who plastered their name, and there's so many sub producers with a ton of talent who you know, maybe they come up and maybe, I mean, it's not like a yesterday issue.
No, it still happens.
What attracted me to the piece, besides Kira and the director and the script and that world.
I love you so much.
But was that it's a tremendously contemporary sensibility. And I think that there's an illusion that the issues we're facing are unique to our time and place. But in fact, so many issues, and I could really get very philosophical and go on at great length, but so many issues.
Go on, we got some time.
Well, I'll just start with the abstract notion. Then we can drill into specific examples.
Okay.
But the movie is very relevant, and so if I'm going to do a period piece, I don't want a period piece that's an artifact or a fossil. I'm not interested in a fossil record of human history. I want things that are vibrant and are relatable and comment on what's going on.
Mm-hmm. I loved it. I love that you're attached to it. And when we talked afterwards, you brought up music. We were talking about your dad, who was involved in music. And I love that story that you told me. Uncle Norby. Can you tell our listeners and our viewers about Uncle Norby and his contribution to the music industry? Because I thought that was fascinating when you told me.
Well, Norby was a great aficionado of black music.
Mm-hmm.
And all through, you know, he's often joked that his memoirs be called From Bebop to Hip Hop.
That is hilarious.
He gave Miles Davis his first job.
That you didn't tell. Now, you didn't tell me that that night. You told me something else.
I was, you know, I got to save a few stories for the podcast.
Gave me a little nugget.
A little taste, you know.
All right. Okay. Reservoir. You just broke off a little piece. Okay.
And I know that that is true. When my dad told me that, I might have looked askance. And then we were at the Grammy Legends, at the Grammys, and it was the Legends Award.
Mm-hmm.
They gave it to Miles Davis
mm-hmm.
that year. And Miles walked over. He said, Norby Walters, you may not remember this, but you gave me my first job. So that's how I knew my dad was telling me the truth. Because there was no, unless my dad went over to him and told him to come over, but I don't think that's the case. No.
Right.
So dad is an original. You've heard of an OG?
Yeah, your dad is the OG for
He's
real.
An OJ. That's old Jew. He's
oh, no, not, an, not an, an OJ. Jew.
It's an OJ.
I cannot say you, but wait, tell them the story you told me that night. Do you remember which one it was? About the rap group?
Is she always so pushy? Yeah.
Yes. I am.
So Norby, well, I want to give you context. I gave you the story,
okay.
But
all right.
I thought we weren't in. Are we in a rush now? Or
no.
We,
no, we're not in a rush.
I'm giving you the.
Oh, so you setting it up for me? Okay, go ahead.
I'm saying that it didn't start with Eric.
Oh, no problem.
It started with
Miles Davis
and Charlie Parker and et cetera, and my dad. I'll skip over some of the great story. We're going to do a documentary about my dad.
Okay.
But my dad, who referred to himself as the accidental agent. but we're going to skip over that part.
Okay.
The accidental part.
Okay.
Became an agent, and he started with what were called lounge groups.
Mm-hmm.
Before disco, in all across the country, in the Hiltons and the Holiday Inns, the big thing to do in Cincinnati and Akron and Dubuque was to go to the local nice chain hotel, mid-level chain hotel, and they would call a top 40 cover act, and they would play all the hits of the day of the 70s. And my dad had hundreds of them, and all of a sudden, one of the groups called City Lights, the lead singer, did a song called Never Can Say Goodbye. Her name was Gloria Gaynor. And so she came out of, my dad had.
Why did I think that was Clifton? I thought Clifton Davis did that first. It was Gloria Gaynor?
Gloria Gaynor.
Oh.
And she became, along with Donna Summers, the queen of disco. And suddenly my dad realized that he could make a lot better living, you know, representing recording artists than lounge acts. They would be making $20,000 a week instead of $200 a night.
Wow.
Instead of $2,000. So he got, and he built up eventually he built up the largest agency for black music. And because he was always interested in civil rights, he never did the kind of, and I don't know if you know the history of oppression of black musicians and all the ripping off of that was done.
Yes, I do.
Probably much better than I do.
Gary Michael Walters, because I actually, before I was a film critic and an actress, I actually was a publicist in the music industry. And so that was my job, to know that background when I had to pitch writers and things on covering our artists. So, yeah, I'm very familiar.
And so Norby never played the side game. He just would book his clients. He'd get them the most money he could. He'd collect the money. He'd take his 10% commission. And on Monday morning, my mom kept the books, by the way.
Of course she did. Your mom's no fool.
No, it was a family affair. And most places settled once a month. Norby, because to be competitive, he settled every Monday morning. And so in the 80s, Dad got very involved in the old school hip hop, and he had Curtis Blow and Sugar Hill Gang, Hotel Motel, and NWA, and all of them. He dominated that sector, and there was one of his groups was called Eric B. and Rakim, and their most famous song off their Eric B. for President record was Paid in Full, and the famous line in there is, "My agent is Norby Walters, and I get paid in full. So. So the point was that it was a way of being. It's a concept of complete and utter devotion to integrity, respect for different cultures, and also understanding how hard it is for a black man to make it in this country. I'm hoping it's getting a little easier, but certainly it's been very hard. And so Norby was always on the forefront of making sure that people were treated with respect. And his famous saying was never too big, never too big to say hello. His door was always open, and many people came, and he mentored many, many people, and just was always very supportive of people, large, small, and completely unknown.
I love that about your dad. To speak to the way that artists of color were treated in terms of how they were paid, that's why the Rhythm and Blues Foundation exists, because a lot of artists were not getting paid royalties on their stuff, and a lot of them in their later years were destitute or couldn't pay their medical bills or whatever. So a lot of artists got together, Ruth Brown and all of those got together to try to raise this money and form the Rhythm and Blues Foundation to make sure that moving forward that this didn't happen to another artist of color. An artist, period, not necessarily an artist of color.
And the contracts in the 50s and the 60s were...
They were raggedy.
They were
raggedy at best.
Very, very lopsided. And I don't want to, I'm not super knowledgeable about all that, but I can say that Dad was part of the change there.
That's wonderful. I'm really glad that you shared that with me, and I'm glad that you shared it with the people that
are
fans.
Very proud of my dad.
You should be. That's something to be proud of, because there are so many other people that do not do that, that do not stand up for the artist, that are so ready to rip the artist or the actor off. To find someone that is actually in your corner and trying to do the right thing is very admirable. So yes, you should be proud of that.
It's not the same, but it's sort of comparable to, for me, the main artist on my movies is the director.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And so we run a kind of a throwback shop of, if I had to compare myself to people say this or that, I look at Robert Evans in that great era of cowboy directors at Paramount under his watch, and that's what I see.
He produced great movies at Paramount,
Godfather and so on. But
The Sting, all of that, yeah.
Those movies won't get made at a studio now. They're unfortunately the
cost too much money.
No, they cost too little money. Too little money. It's not the companies are going for theme parks and merchandise, and they want this four quadrant experience.
I see.
And so the mid level movies have really fallen on hard times.
Okay, so talk to me about. I don't know that much about being a producer on a film. Talk to me about the process from the time you get a script and you decide this is something that I want to be involved with to the point where you get the stars attached, you get the director attached, you know, get somebody to scout locations and talk to us about that process, because I have no idea what that process is.
I would also like to know how you got started.
Yeah, all of that. Break it down.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pieces to the producing puzzle, and it's kind of shifted. In the old days, there was a studio, and they provided a home for everybody, and then you didn't worry about things like how does it sell, and how does it get financed, and who's in it, and all these things, because the studio had said, okay, we'll put this one and that one and that one and this one, and you just went and actually just the producer made the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And now, at least in the indie world, there's so many pieces to the puzzle. So the script is a process. Is it coming in as a script, finished script, a script that needs work, a pitch, a book that needs to be developed, a life story that needs to be developed? Is it from scratch? Is it a script that you're further developing? Is it a ready-to-go script?
That's a lot.
So each one of those, just the script alone, who should be the appropriate writer?
Mm.
So I am the CEO of a company called Bold Films. So because we're a financing shop, we don't necessarily plant all the seeds sometimes.
I see.
Sometimes we just reap the fruit the producer. So customarily, I'll work. The producer will be another one of my talent.
I see.
I look at producers as very talented people who find stories, shape them, and build these projects, and then go on set and see it to fruition. I've been more on the business side of producing. I've been over the last, say, out of a, call it 15-year producing career,
mm-hmm.
I'd say only in the last 3 or 4 years have I really started to do a deep dive on the creative side, on the script development, on the packaging, on the hiring of the director, on the being on set and managing the post-production process. In the early days at the company, more projects came in as what are called packages. I don't know if you're familiar with that term.
Yes, I am.
Or
a package deal, you mean?
A package is basically a script, a director,
yeah.
and a movie star
attached,
who carries the budget. Mm-hmm. By carries the budget means that the value of this package is such that when you go to sell it, hopefully it's more than what it costs to make it.
Okay.
Some complex financial thoughts I'm introducing here today.
It's not that complex. I mean, you know, I have a friend who is a Academy Award winning actress.
Uh-huh.
And I remember before she became that, she talked very candidly about getting with an agency that had packaging power. So that's the only reason why I know what that means, was because of her. Because she broke it down for me and let me know.
And although we talk about agents having packaging powers, in my experience, it's not the agency that packages that much anymore.
Mm.
It's really more the producer and the director reaching out directly, because in general, the more interesting work, the mid-priced movies that I work in, are not going to offer the kind of, to be blunt, payday
mm-hmm.
to whoever, producer, mm-hmm. actor, director. And so therefore, well, my dad was an agent for many years, so the bigger the offer, the more interested he was to take that phone call.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're offering small dollars, the agencies are just sadly not that interested, even mm-hmm. if it's a beautiful project. So there's a lot of relationships. And fortunately, there are great actors like Keira Knightley who will support working, you know.
She's a producer on Colette, yes?
No, she's not a producer on Colette.
Why did I think she was?
Okay. But she is our leading lady, and she, you know, supported the project by coming in on very reasonable terms and helping the whole thing happen.
All right, so how did Colette come into your realm?
Colette, actually, that actually came from a packaging department, although they hadn't put the package together necessarily. What happens is, once the package is together, usually it will land in the finance division of mm-hmm. one of the agencies. In this case, it was a very powerful agent, CAA, Creative Artists Agency. And they sent it over, and I'm sure they sent it to a few other financiers, and we raised our hand and we were aggressive. We were tenacious. I also had just opened up a London office, and I was very eager.
Look at you.
To make a splash in the UK.
Okay.
So this was the perfect...
perfect vehicle to do so?
Yeah, I had an idea, just to step back from the particulars of the project. I had an idea when we opened up the London office to blend sort of Hollywood showmanship and muscular storytelling with European sophistication and stories. And Colette seemed like that perfect opportunity, something that was a rousing story, entertaining, but also dealing with the cafe society, Belle Epoque, just important cultural issues. So it wasn't necessarily the kind of story that pops up here in L.A.
No, it was shot very well, and I really enjoyed it. We have a chat room for this show because we are on YouTube and Spotify and iTunes. And in our chat room on iTunes, Michael B., who's one of our regular people that watches, he said to tell you that he's glad that you're on today.
Oh, and that thank you, Michael B.
He's going to now try to produce his first film, and that he's loving the notes that you're giving in that regard.
Oh, well, good luck. Every movie is a labor of love. It's hard and not getting easier. So any way I can give any tools, it's my pleasure.
All right, so let's flip from Colette. Thank you so much for what you said about the producing, because honestly, I really wanted you here to talk about that, because I really wanted to understand what it was producers do. Because I hear I produce thrown around all the time, but I wasn't clear about exactly what that entailed.
Well, just to lay a few additional notes in there.
Okay.
There's different pieces of it. So there's the early piece, the finding of the story, the developing of the script. That's very important. There's the attaching of the director and the actor. That's very important. There's the finding, the finance. That's also very important. And then there's actually the making of the movie, and that's the look and feel, and that's working with the director, find the right production designer, costume designer, composer, cinematographer, editor, and then executing in a way that fulfills the overall idea or vision of the filmmaker, and then bringing all those pieces together in post-production and editing and finishing that music. And then, of course, sometimes you have this sort of testing process, or if you don't have a formal testing process, to get audience reactions, invariably the director will use what's called a friends and families screenings and get feedback. And so all through the completion. Now, in the old days, the producer also was very involved in the marketing, and a little bit still these days, big producers are really deeply involved in their marketing as well.
I'm glad you broke it down for us, sister. I appreciate you.
Sure. Well, that's why when you see like five different names, you're like, well, how?
Right.
Five people.
Exactly.
I mean, that's five people, all doing the same thing. No, it's probably four people doing four different things, and one person was friends of somebody, so they just got a credit because they were just.
So that's hilarious. I have a question.
Managed somebody, you know. Stuck their name on there. Definitely. I'm just about to start getting myself in trouble today.
No, don't get yourself in trouble. We don't want you to do that.
I take that back, everybody. Every
No, you're right. I know some
they're
folks.
They're all deserved.
No, I know. You're absolutely right. I know some folks that got credit on films as a producer because they knew somebody that knew somebody, and, you know, they didn't help have anything to do with the finance or anything like that. You were going to say something, Scott?
Oh, I was just going to ask, just out of curiosity, what's the difference between a regular producer and an executive producer?
Well, it tends to focus on deal-making versus movie-making, just to kind of break it down to two broad categories.
Mm-hmm.
The creative side versus the sales or deal-making or raising of financing tend to be monitoring, overseeing, so in my executive producer functions, I'll be looking at what are called cost reports. And every week there's a report comes in, how much did the movie spend? Are we on budget? Are we over budget? Are we on schedule or behind schedule? Very once in a while, you're ahead of schedule slightly.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't last long. And I've never seen anything under budget, although you have in the indie world, you have something called a contingency, and that's just for variety of expenses that may not be budgeted. You just always have a need for various things, or you go 2 hours late one day, you dip into your contingent funds. And I've had movies where I used very, very little of that, so that's almost like going under budget.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about, so you've produced this one film, Colette, which is a period piece. And then you've also produced this year alone, you've got two pieces that I know of. You might probably have more that I don't know.
No, two in
just
the
just these two.
Two in the sort of conversation this
okay.
year.
Okay. So the other one is Vox Lux, and that one stars Natalie Portman.
And Jude Law.
And I saw this film. It's a very interesting film. It's got like this kind of avant-garde thing. The way that the credits are done is very mm-hmm. non-traditional.
I call it my boldest bet.
It was, and Natalie Portman in it is really quite phenomenal. I don't think we've ever seen her do anything like this before. She's quite interesting in this film, and I enjoyed it.
She is in full diva mode.
Yes, yeah, she is.
She plays a complicated.
Huge pop rock
mm-hmm. punk star on her comeback tour,
mm-hmm.
and as you know, if you're on a comeback tour, that means you went up and then maybe you went down a little bit,
right? Exactly.
And what does that do to your person? Of course, she also in the film she has a horrific incident in the beginning. That
yes,
shapes
a tragedy
her.
That shapes the rest of her life.
Yep.
Yeah. That was that right there, the beginning of this film was so shocking for me that I didn't know where it was going to go. And then when I saw where it went and how it ended up, I'm like, well, okay. That sat with me for a couple of days, and it sat in my spirit for a couple of days because it was upsetting to me, especially in light of what's going on in our world right now. It was very upsetting, but it was very eye-opening and very brave of you guys to attack that type of thing and that type of personality. Because as we spoke about earlier in the music industry, what happens in the music industry, as you and I both know, is that, or in the entertainment industry, period, people, including the media and fans, they love to build you up and love you, love you, love you. And then the minute you get to a certain pinnacle, then they tear you down.
Yep.
And then they love to revel in the fact that they've torn you down. And then they really start to beat on you. Like, it's almost like throwing stones at a glass house, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Well, I was joking about the other day because I've been fortunate. I've gotten a lot of good press over the years, the company, our movies, myself. And then I got not such a good article. So I'm like, oh, look at this article. It's not so good. I'm like, that just shows I'm doing well enough. Now people want to start taking shots. I was never important. No, why tear down someone you never heard of? So I took
so
that.
So you know what I mean?
I took
firsthand.
Took it as a compliment.
Yeah, I mean, it happens all the time. But this, like you said, this story is about this young lady and her sister who experienced this really unfortunate tragedy. And as unfortunate as that tragedy is, it opens up a career for her that she never saw coming. But that career almost destroys her in the process. And then she has a comeback, which ends up being a little bit more difficult than I think even she had anticipated it being. There's one scene in that film that I laughed out loud. And the only reason I laughed out loud is because as a journalist, it's my life.
The round table scene
where they do the round table interviews, and there's always one person at
goes into the off limits topics.
Yes, there's always that. No matter what the publicist tells you, there's always one person at the table
that goes there,
and you're like, dang, you just gonna mess it up for the rest of us, really? And you just want to punch them in their throat because they messed up, right?
Yep.
I saw that and I laughed out loud and I was like, oh, I kind of love this. I'm really interested to see, because the film has not been released yet.
December 7th.
Yes, I'm really interested to see what
through Neon, to see what
journalists are going to have to say, especially because that scene is in there. I'm really interested to see how they're going to react to the film, but I liked it, so there's that. That's all I got to say about that.
The movie, it is very jarring in a lot of ways. I mean, the first half of the movie is very unexpected if you just read the plot description. But it's really impactful. I feel like I took a lot away from it. The second half kind of goes to show you, like you were talking about, the rise and the fall of the pop star. And I Natalie Portman just kills it in this movie. I just think she's incredible in it. And I love the voiceover by Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, Willem Dafoe does a great job. the...
I think you got two hits on your hands, Gary.
Well, they're you put them out in the world, and Colette is doing nicely at the box office. I mean, it's not a huge release, but we just crossed 5 million this weekend, I believe.
Yeah, I read that.
So we're chugging along. Andrew Carpin up at Bleecker Street is just a phenomenal distributor, and he's worked four times with Kira back when he was running Focus. So it was great to have someone. The materials on that have all been incredible. So it's great to have someone who really understands the material and the artist to put it out there. Vox Lux were just because it's a movie of a lot of it's just chock-a-block with ideas. Right now, I think that a lot of people, when they go to the movies, are looking for comfort food. The world is so stressful; they want to
just have something, veg out
something
and
easy. This is not that movie. This is.
Yeah.
Here's comfort food. Here's Vox Lux.
Yeah.
And so you know, when we watched the movie, the producers, no one actually had any comments afterwards. No one had notes. We were like, we need to absorb this. We need to digest this. We need to contemplate what we just saw. There's a lot to it.
But you know what we don't need to contemplate? And this is our commercial break for Black Hollywood Live. BHL fans, Black Hollywood Live is the first urban digital broadcast network in existence. And since its inception, BHL has prided itself on creating outstanding content in all areas from news, music, and politics to lifestyle and entertainment. We've not only given a voice to the often underserved Black and Latino community here at Black Tomatoes. We've also provided new hosts with the dopest platform to exercise their talents, and that is not all, yo. BHL has done the same for many Hollywood's A-lists, including Lady Ole Miss Oprah Winfrey. Yeah, I said it. Oprah, whom has made several multiple BHL appearances and given us several shout-outs. Now, Black Hollywood Live needs your help. How can you do that? I'm going to tell you how. By subscribing to our YouTube channel, giving us some love over at Spotify, giving us some love over on iTunes. That's how. Now, subscribing to our YouTube channel will help you find other new shows on the channel that I'm sure you'll love, but you're not going to love them more than Black Tomatoes, I'm just saying. And if you're worried about annoying notifications, don't be, they are totally optional. So, hit the subscribe button now. Hit the subscribe button now. It helps. And it eases us into continuing our work. Let us know you did in the comments, and we'll show you some love on air like I did Michael B. a little earlier and Miss Yana, who's in the chat room now. Thanks for being supportive fans to BHL. We love y'all. And helping us take the network to the next level and continue to redefine Hollywood. Thank you.
There you go.
Black Hollywood Live. Right on.
You did not bust out right on. See, I knew you was just going to bust out with some crazy stuff sooner or later. I knew you would do that. I just want to let you know that
really well behaved so far.
You have been. I'm like, where is the Gary I met at the party? Where he at? You being all serious? I'm like, what's up? But the people in our chat room that are watching the show are really loving having you on. They're really intrigued by this conversation. And I just want to thank you for being so gracious and coming on and having that conversation with us. Because we oftentimes have talent here. We hardly ever have people behind the scenes. So I really appreciate you coming and talking about it from that vantage point.
Absolutely.
All right. Moving on. So, as I said earlier in the show, we have two streaming picks of the week. Now, I asked y'all if y'all had heard about these Bill Murray stories. Have you heard about it?
I saw it on Rotten Tomatoes, but I have no idea what it is.
Okay.
It's new?
Kind of, sort of.
Newish.
So when I was at Toronto, there was this film called Bill Murray Stories, right? And I thought, I like Bill Murray. Let me check this out and see what this is about. I bet it's really cool. So I'm checking it out, and I'm looking, and it's a documentary about this guy named Tommy Avalone, who's a documentary filmmaker, who has heard these Bill Murray stories, and evidently there are a multitude of stories about Bill Murray just popping up in various places. Like, there's some dorm that he popped up at in some foreign country where he popped up in this dorm and washed the kids' dishes. He popped up at a soccer game and played soccer with people.
Is this like Dave Chappelle's Rick James stories? Or?
What kind of sort of? And then he like walked by some, he was in some restaurant and walked by somebody and grabbed French fries off their plate. Like these random stories that these people tell. And people are like, you'll never believe this, but Bill Murray, blah, blah, blah. So Tommy Avalone decided he was going to make a whole documentary documenting all these Bill Murray stories. And then he actually was going to try to meet Bill Murray himself, right?
It's very hard to get to Bill Murray.
That's what he was saying.
He has a
1-800 number or something crazy like that. And he has no representation.
No, he has no agent. He has no manager. He does have a lawyer. And if you want to speak to Bill Murray, you have to send a letter. He has a P.O. box.
Oh, now he has a P.O. box. Because in this documentary, he had a 1-800 number, and you had to call the 1-800 number.
He has a P.O. box.
That's hysterical.
And then it's like, it's like Casablanca. You send it, and then you're waiting and waiting and waiting.
And that's what Tommy says, but you would think that the whole joke of the movie would be, or the whole premise of the movie would be, these various crazy stories. But the actual premise of the movie is, because Bill Murray is doing what he's doing, he's just kind of yes-anding his way through life, which is the number one rule of improv, yes-and, right?
Yeah. Second City.
Yes, so he's kind of just yes-anding his way through life and basically telling society, look, take one day at a time. Don't take life so serious. Just take it one day at a time and live your life like one big improv. So I wanted to give a shout out to Tommy Avalone's Bill Murray stories because I thought it was hysterical. And Tommy actually tried to meet Bill Murray himself. Through all of his efforts, it didn't happen. And then he randomly showed up at some baseball game where Bill Murray was and they took a selfie together.
Oh.
Which after years of trying to track him down to get him as an interview subject for this film, it never happened, and then he randomly shows up at this baseball game. It was so funny, but it made me laugh because I'm crazy like that.
I almost had Bill Murray attached to something I was working on, and then the elusive Bill Murray slipped through the cracks. Slipped through my neck. That was a timing thing.
See,
you know?
And now we have another Bill Murray story.
Yes.
I was ready to go gung-ho. I don't want to call anybody out.
You don't have to.
I'm not, but there was the producers, they just, Bill wanted to work with a certain actress and who I loved. I won't name any names. And
no need to.
The producer was not a fan of that person. And so, and that person, you know, Bill and that person would have carried the movie. And then that person, we didn't go with the person.
Other person.
And then the window with Bill was gone. And once Bill's gone.
He's gone.
He's not coming back.
Tommy Avalone, if you are listening to this.
And neither did that movie, by the way.
Tommy Avalone, if you are listening to this or watching this, this is your other Bill Murray story. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
But you can catch Bill Murray stories. You can buy the DVD or Blu-ray, I believe, on BillMurrayStories.com, or you can check it on iTunes. It was released on the 26th of this month. It was just released. The other streaming pick of the week is one of my favorites because I love Peanuts so much.
Charles Schulz. American treasure.
Yes. So we're approaching Halloween. Halloween is actually next week, and they showed
Great Pumpkin.
It's a Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown. That is my favorite Charlie Brown.
That never gets old.
Because Linus in that pumpkin patch waiting for the Great Pumpkin is everything. It is so funny to me. And the stuff that he thinks he sees, but he doesn't really see it, like all these possibilities of what the Great Pumpkin may or may not be, it just makes me laugh out loud. It's
kind of
so
like
funny.
Waiting for Godot.
Exactly. It is my favorite thing ever. So you guys, check out It's a Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, or It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown. It is streaming everywhere. You can buy it on Amazon. You can see it everywhere. I'm sure they'll show it again before Halloween is over, so check that out. So the two streaming picks, of the week, just to reiterate, are It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, the Charles Schulz classic story, and Bill Murray Stories, which is streaming on iTunes right now. Now, moving on, I wanted to do a sneak peek of the week because there wasn't a film that usually we do what I call a movieversary, so we celebrate a movie anniversary, but there wasn't a film that was celebrating a movieversary this week. So I was like, what could we do? And then I thought, we're talking about Vox Lux, that's kind of a rock thing. Let's do a sneak peek of Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh, nice.
Because that's coming out. So I think we have the trailer. For those on YouTube, you can watch, and for those on Spotify and iTunes, you can take a listen.
Going in a landslide. enjoyed the show.
I also write songs. Our lead singer just quit. Then you'll need someone new.
I love the way you move on stage. The whole room belongs to you. Don't you see what you could be?
No one will play us on the radio.
We need to get experimental.
Thunderbolts and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Do it again.
One more.
How many more Galileos do you want?
Roger, there's only room in this band for one hysterical queen.
Mark these words. No one will play a queen.
Fortune favors the bold.
Freddie, concerning your private life.
What more do you need to know? I make music.
I want to give the audience a song that they can perform.
What's the lyric?
Sing it, we will rock you. On.
Ready, Freddy?
Let's do it.
We are the champions, my friend.
You need to slow down, Fred.
I just need a bit of time.
If I don't have time.
We are the champions. We are the champions. No time for losers, 'cause we are the champions.
You're a legend, Fred.
We're all legends.
Let me tell y'all some about some Bohemian. Have you seen Bohemian Rhapsody, Gary?
I have not.
Dude, you gotta see it.
Yes.
You gotta see it. Because it is... Every movie... This is the thing about this particular award season that we're about to embark upon. Every time I see a film, I'm like, oh, that's my new favorite film. Every week I see a film, I'm like, oh, that's my new favorite film. When I saw Bohemian Rhapsody, I had a special affection for this film in particular, and I'm gonna tell you why. So, I think I told you I sing, too, right? I told you that, right?
No.
Oh, so I sing. So, so I sing. And there was a musical called We Will Rock You that Queen produced. And they produced it at the Paris Las Vegas Hotel and Casino. And they were looking for somebody to play the role of Killer Queen. They hired me.
Amazing.
Right. So, this is the thing I want to share, because it's unbelievable. So, I remember at the audition was the song Another One Bites the Dust, right? Freddie Mercury's range is so freaking high as a dude that for a girl to sing Another One Bites the Dust in the key that it's written in for him, it would be ridiculous. Like, you'd have to have some crazy, ridiculous range to sing that. So they dropped the octave of the first part of the song really, really low so that you would have some place to go range-wise, right? So it was really down in the basement. Nobody could sing it but me, to the point where Brian May was at the audition. Him and Roger were sitting at the table auditioning everybody that was there, to the point where Brian May literally got up from behind the table and came and sat at the piano because he wanted to hear for himself that I actually could hit this note as solidly as it was sounding like I could hit it. And he was sitting there playing the piano. Now, for me, I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. And I'm just like... I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. Queen was my favorite rock group growing up. And now I'm at an audition where Brian May is playing Another One Bites the Dust for me. Like, what is happening in my life right now? It was crazy. So when I went to see Bohemian Rhapsody, I just had this influx of memories of that moment, of that time, of what it was like to work for them and what it was like to do that show. And I was also reminded that this is one of the few rock groups in music history that never really broke up. They stayed together. They never really broke up, and they made a pact that they would split things four ways, you know, after some drama, because all rock groups and all music groups have drama. But after some little dramatic stuff happened, they made a pact that they would stick together and split things four ways. And I have to applaud Brian May and Roger for keeping the brand of Queen intact after all these years, because Freddie died, I believe, it was like the 80s or 90s, I think.
Who's the lead singer now?
It's Adam Lambert from American Idol, who, if they were going to get somebody to be a lead singer and it wasn't Freddie Mercury, Adam Lambert certainly fits the bill.
Have you seen them live with Adam Lambert?
Mm-hmm.
How does he...
He's amazing.
He delivers?
Oh, yeah. And then some. He's amazing.
I heard that the band was very involved in the production of.
Yes, they produced the film. Mm-hmm. They were very involved in the musical that we did. I mean, they would come and see it all the time. They would come and play with us sometimes.
Do you feel they sanitized the story? I've seen that in the press.
Sanitize the story?
Did they sanitize it a little bit? Because I can tell you, the Straight Outta Compton, that was not sanitized. That was what happened. My dad represented that. That was real.
I don't know if it was sanitized. I don't know if it was sanitized.
I didn't feel like it was.
Mm-hmm. As a person watching it, I didn't get that feeling. But I wasn't there, mm-hmm. and I didn't know them during that time, so I couldn't speak on that. I can only speak on what's happened since Freddie. And I know that Roger and Brian do everything they can to keep that brand very much alive, mm-hmm. very much alive. When we were doing We Will Rock You in Vegas, they had Constantine Maroulis was on American Idol at the time, and he sang Bohemian Rhapsody as one of his songs. And he did it so well that Queen decided to release a tribute album, and they asked the cast of We Will Rock You to come sing backup for Constantine on The Tonight Show when Jay Leno was doing it. Mm. And so we all flew to L.A., and we did The Tonight Show singing behind Constantine. And Brian and them, you know, they sanctioned that. So they're very involved. And I just, this was a personal like for me. So I'm like, I don't care what anybody say about Bohemian Rhapsody. I'm going to like it anyway. Because I like Queen, and I just like the way the movie was executed. And I like the fact that they told the truth about Freddie, and they humanized Freddie. And they humanized him, and they told the truth about him, I felt.
I loved it, too. I mean, it's weird because when you went to your screening, I saw your reaction on Twitter. And when I went to my screening, everyone who I talked to who was around me was singing. You know, they were, you know, moving their feet. Everyone loved this movie. And then the reviews came out, and it's like middle-of-the-road reviews. And it's weird because every single person I know who's seen this movie has loved it.
The critics that I was with, they applauded, and they were living their life. So I don't know who these people are that are poo-pooing it. But
I don't know either.
You know, but everybody's right. That's the thing. That's the wonderful thing about the country that we live in. Everybody can have an opinion and say what they want and not be crucified as a result of it. So
there are a lot of music movies out.
Yes. I know, but I'm loving that. I'm loving that.
Star is Born.
Yeah, Vox Lux.
They're doing that. I love that they're doing the marketing for Vox Lux with not a different type of Star is Born. I like that. I saw that before we came in.
Hmm. All right. Well, you should go see it, Gary, because Gary, did you like Queen? Did you like the rock group Queen? You don't care.
Come on now. Of course. I mean, that's...
I mean, some people didn't like Queen. Some people like Aerosmith better than they like Queen. Some people liked... What's the other one?
Rolling Stones?
Well, everybody likes the Stones, but ain't nobody gonna be like, you know, Mick Jagger.
You too?
Huh?
You too?
Yeah, some people that like U2 don't like Queen.
It's weird.
You know, it's just groups are very, rock fans are very territorial
I am not. I'm very like Baskin Robbins. I like all the, I like all the different
you like
I'm
all
so, I'm stealing that. I'm so stealing that from this day forward. Did you want to share anything else about what you got coming up next?
Well, I think what we're going to do that's a little different. I'm very excited. I really feel like the best is about to come out of my shop.
Ooh.
And what we're doing is leaning in to bigger stories, more scope. I feel like these beautiful smaller movies are just having just a very, very difficult time getting out there, finding an audience. It's gotten very challenging. A lot of the more challenging fare has migrated to television. Mm-hmm. And so I've got a couple of really exciting larger scale projects. The Chippendale story with Ben Stiller.
I remember you telling me about that, yeah.
So you've got sort of this twisted Boogie Nights, you know, darkly comic thriller.
You going to have a cameo?
And in the front.
You notice how he ignored me.
Eye candy. You know, I don't work on my own movies. I'm offer only, by the way, to all directors, casting people. Just make me an offer, but I don't read. I'll take a meeting. I don't read.
You'll take a meeting. Oh my God, that is pure comedy. Are you planning on doing anything with people of color in the future? Like some Bollywood or some African American or some Latino or Asian?
Well, Dev Patel is Indian. He's the star of the movie, so.
Oh, the Chippendales movie?
Yeah.
Oh, so you left that out. We didn't know.
I think I said his name. I said his Did name you? First. I said Dev and
Oh, I didn't hear
ben
that.
Stiller,
I heard Ben Stiller. I didn't hear.
I didn't hear that. I heard Ben Stiller.
No, Dev Patel is the star of the movie.
Oh, okay.
So basically, it's a story of, Horatio Alger story gone horribly wrong, and it's Dev Patel. Well, it's got to be bold. It's got to be twisted, or it's just not going to catch my attention. It's got to be something.
It's twisted, so it's
edgy.
You.
You know, it's got to be smart and edgy and have something to say. That's a bold film. Mm-hmm. And
that's the name of your company.
That's sort of our DNA. So, well, we broke Riz Ahmed in Nightcrawler. He's Pakistani. And now I'm working on the other side of the divide over in India. And in terms of, let's say, African-American mm-hmm. theme projects, I would love to do more of that. The issue has been, and I don't want to make excuses for why I haven't done more, because it's something I've been thinking about a lot, mm-hmm. you know, sitting down with, whether it's Will Packer or this one, or Chris Tucker, like meeting, like trying to figure this out. The indie model, and sadly a lot of the foreign territories are not as supportive of African-American leads as the American market is. Mm-hmm. And so when you're looking for 70% of your budget mm-hmm. from foreign, it becomes challenging. With our new model, where we're going to be leaning more into global distribution in partnership with the U.S. studio, mm-hmm. I'm really hopeful there's actually one project with an amazing, amazing African-American lead and a very well-known Caucasian actor I think multicultural stories is what interests me, because that's the world that I inhabit. I don't want to tell necessarily men's stories or women's stories or white stories or black stories. They're all very interesting, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. I would not be the right guy to make Crazy Rich Asians, because that's so particular. You need that director's touch. You need people with tremendous cultural sensitivity to mm-hmm. handle the issues particular to the culture. Mm-hmm. But the multicultural world, a world in which all of the races and religions and genders have a seat at the table and have a voice in the conversation, that is where I'm trying to drive my company right now. That's what personally interests me the most.
Okay. Well, again, for the 5,000th time, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Gary Michael Walters,
thank
for
you.
Joining us
thank
here
you,
at
Carla.
Black Tomatoes.
What a pleasure.
I really appreciate you
more than
you'll ever know. Where can people find you on Twitter and Instagram if you're on that platform?
Gary Michael Walters.
Yay.
Just look, that'll find me everywhere.
Gary Michael Walters. And your company is Bold Films. They can find that online as well, yes?
Boldfilms.com.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So for episode 36 of Black Tomatoes, we are going to check out and talk about Boy Erased, Nobody's Fool, Homecoming with Julia Roberts, and Nutcracker and the Four Realms. But until that time, I am your host, Carla Renata. You can find me across all social media platforms at The Curvy Critic. You can also check me out at the General Hospital After Show right after this at 6 o'clock on AfterBuzz TV. And on Monday nights on AfterBuzz TV, I am the host of Dancing with the Stars After Show. Where can we find you, Scott?
You can find me at weliveentertainment.com. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at TheOtherScottM. And as always, a pleasure to be here.
Yay! Okay, until the next time, see y'all. Love, peace, and hair grease. Bye.
From executives Kevin Undergaro, Dario Kristen, Tiana Hobson, and the entire BHL staff, we would like to thank you for supporting Black Hollywood Live, the first online broadcast network dedicated to African-American entertainment. For questions and comments, contact us. info@blackhollywoodlive.com. Like us on Facebook, tweet us, or Instagram us at BHL Online. And I am the official voice of Black Hollywood Live, Scipio. Instagram me at KingXOBay. Thanks for tuning in.
Hollywood Redefined.
The views expressed here are those of the host only and do not necessarily reflect the views of BHL or its owners or principals.